Big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast, and a theme that we are embracing for this series in 2021 is inclusive heritage. This will involve a broad overview of the multi-layered experiences which encompass Ireland's past, and will also put into context how this sense of heritage is all about our collective experience, and why so much of what went before still resonates in the present. I hope you enjoy the show. This month, we mark the 50th anniversary of the introduction of decimalisation in Ireland. On today's podcast, Michael E. Kenny, Chairman of the Numismatic Society of Ireland, and Michael Kenny, a retired museum curator, whose working life included 20 years at the National Museum, chart the long and varied story of money and coinage in Ireland. Discover how Irish people have been influenced by the use of money. How has money reflected social and economic trends? And we also look at the landmark dates marking major changes to Irish coinage, including 1823, 1928, 1971, and 2002. And also we hear about the Vikings, coinage, siege money, and politics. I hope you enjoy the show. A big welcome to Michael Kenny, who's chairman of the Numismatic Society of Ireland. Did I get that right, Michael?
You did indeed.
Just about. Greg,
thank you very much.
A big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast. And we're talking about one of my favorite topics, money. It's 50 years since the anniversary of the introduction of decimalization to Ireland, which would have been a big change and an adjustment at the time. And I know that's the topic of our conversation and getting a little bit deeper into currency and how that would have changed with different political events and everything else. But before I get into all that, could you tell me a little bit about your society? Because I believe this year is a big landmark as well.
Yes, the Numismatic Society of Ireland was founded in March 1961, that's 60 years ago, at a meeting at the Dolphin Hotel in Dublin by 10 members who decided to form a society for the promotion and research of coinage, especially Irish coinage. And it's been going for 60 years. We have meetings every month from September to May. We have field trips in the summer. We attend overseas conferences, especially in Britain. And we have a branch in Belfast that has been going since 1963. And since the lockdown, our monthly meetings now are held online via Zoom. So it's a thriving society.
Obviously, it's an interest in coin collecting.
Yes.
What are the big matters of interest, do you know? What are the things that take all of your attention?
I collect obsolete coins, especially half crowns were always my favourite. And the reason for this is they go back in the British series to 1551 in the reign of Edward VI. So you've an unbroken succession of half crowns. You can have one of each monarch of each type going back for over 400 years. But coins themselves in Ireland have gone back 1,000 years. In Britain, they go back 2,000 years because they were a Roman province for the best part of four centuries. And these days, there are Roman coins being dug up all over Britain because they were buried in the ground. There were no banks. There were no secure holdings. They were buried. And very often between battles and skirmishes, they were never recovered. And these days, with the advent of metal detectors, there's not a day goes by when somebody doesn't find a hoard of Roman coins. Now, you won't find them in Ireland because although the Romans raided and traded, they didn't conquer or colonize. But nevertheless, Irish coins go back 1,000 years to the time of the Vikings, who established mints in Dublin, Trim and Waterford 1,000 years ago.
And tell me, Michael, the coins at the time, the value was linked to the metals they were on.
Yeah, they had an intrinsic value. These early coins were silver pennies. There were 240 of them to a pound. A pound is Latin librium, which means pound, and the L is still the pound sign. So there were 240 pennies, and they had a cross on the reverse So you could cut it in half to make a half penny, or cut it into a quarter to make a fourthing or a farthing.
Yeah, because as you said, it had intrinsic value.
Yeah, made of silver, yeah.
So when did coins stop being produced with that intrinsic value? What date did that happen?
It happened in Britain after the First World War, when silver coins were made of sterling silver, 92.5% fine. But because of repaying debts to the Americans, they debased it by 50%. So they became 50% silver. After the Second World War, the silver went completely. So it's just a token coinage made of cupronickel, which is a mixture of copper and nickel. But in between, there was a man who was way ahead of his time. You've all heard of the Williamite Wars up in the north, especially the Battle of the Boyne, when William III joined battle with James II. James II hadn't enough money to pay his troops. So what did he do? He was promised money by Louis XIV, which never arrived. So he made money out of base metal, half crowns, shillings, sixpences, and he made them out of old church bells, cannons, and any old base metal of brass and copper he found lying around. And the idea was he would redeem these for good silver when he won the war. Unfortunately, he didn't win the war. So they became worthless afterwards.
So that was the end of that experiment.
Yeah, 1689, 1690. It was only an experiment. But as I said, it was ahead of his time, because today all the coins throughout the world are made of base metal.
Obviously, 50 years ago was a big milestone, you know, 50 years of decimalization. And in our conversation earlier, I think we picked out a few landmarks when it comes to currency in Ireland and significant changes. So the first big date when it comes to currency would have been 1823, which followed the Act of Union. Could you explain to me the changes that occurred at that time?
Well, we all know the Act of Union took place 1800, 1801. It came into effect. But the currencies weren't united till 1823. So we still had coins minted 1822 and 23 with King George IV on the obverse and the Irish harp on the reverse. Although we were that part of the British Empire, there was still a separate coinage struck for Ireland. After 1823, the two exchequers were united, so there were no more Irish coins for 105 years until 1828, when the Free State coinage came in. Our more senior people would remember the old animal coins that go back that far.
And that change took a long time, didn't it? Why did it take so long, or do we have any idea?
Well, after independence in 1922, there were a lot more urgent things on the government, the new government's plate, apart from the War of Independence, the Civil War, and all the mayhem that followed. Getting their own currency was put a little bit on the long finger, but it wasn't too long. In 1926, the Currency Commission held a board chaired by W.B. Yeats, who decided on a new currency. It went out to competition, and it was won by Percy Metcalfe, and he did the lovely animal designs that came into circulation in 1928. So I think they did it fairly quickly, really, considering the turmoil of the day.
That was cause for big celebration, I think, here, you know, having your independence again. Did that upset currencies and what money was worth at that time, that change?
No, not in the least, because it was linked to sterling, which was the sterling and the dollar were the major world currencies. So the fact that it was linked to sterling meant that it wouldn't go the way of the Italian lira or the Spanish peseta. And so on and so forth. It was based at parity on a one-to-one basis. And the two currencies did circulate right up until decimalisation for the next 40 years, side by side. You could spend English or Irish money in Ireland, no problem.
And the two currencies did circulate?
They did,
quite
yes.
Freely, okay.
Yeah.
But yet at the same time, Irish money didn't work in England.
No, they wouldn't take it, no. No rabbits here, one guy said when I tried to offer one over a bar. That was the threatens with the hair on it.
What was Patrick Pearse's famous quote?
His quote was that any time an Irishman holds a penny in his hand, he should feel deeply ashamed. because it wasn't an Irish penny in 1916, it was an English penny with the head of King George V. So in 1928, the king's head disappeared and it was replaced by the harp and then the lovely animals on the other side, although George V was still nominally a head of state under the terms of the treaty.
And could you tell me the history of the harp? And it wasn't Arthur Guinness, I believe, from my chat.
No, not at all, no. Although I'm fond of the old Guinness myself. No, the harp first appeared on an Irish coin in the reign of our old friend King Henry VIII. He was a big buddy of Pope Leo X. On a visit to Rome, he was conferred with the title Defender of the Faith. That is the Catholic faith. And it was a treatise in defence of Catholicism against Lutheranism. But then he fell out with the Pope because the Pope wouldn't give him a divorce to his wife, Catherine of Aragon, so he could marry Anne Boleyn. So they fell out. But whilst they were still buddies, as a going away present, he was given this harp by the Pope. And it's the Trinity harp, which resides in Trinity College to this day. It's the so-called Brian Boru harp. And it appears on all our coins. Even under the euro coins, we still have the harp. It's the national emblem of Ireland. And it's based on you can see this harp in Trinity College Library. And that's the one that is based on all the Irish coins. But Henry VIII first produced it in the 1530s. And it's appeared on most Irish coins ever since.
And Michael, that strange currency that we were using up until 1971, that was a little bit complicated. So just to break it down a little bit, a pound was a pound. That's fine. Beyond that, you need to start explaining to me the different bits and pieces that made up.
Yeah, pounds, shillings and pence. Pounds was a pound of silver, librium. And the letter L is still the pound sign. There were 20 shillings to the pound.
Yeah, and in my book, that's 5 pence, so that's nice and straightforward.
5 pence, and there were 12 pence to the shilling.
Yeah, this now is where it gets complicated.
Gets complicated, and there were 240 pennies to the pound.
Okay.
It's called the duodecimal system, because the beauty of this is that if you take 12 as a base, you can half it and you can quarter it. Half of 12, 6, and then 3, which you can't do so easily with the decimal 10. You go into fractions or decimal points. So LSD, pounds, solidus, denarius. It's a throwback from Roman times.
And I know myself in 1971, I'm giving away my age now, being sent across the road to the corner shop with all of these odd pieces of money. And I had an expression in my head, which is 2 and 6 pence. And I actually thought that was a number of coins, but you say it was a specific coin.
It was. My favourite coin, Greg, the half crown.
Yeah.
The half crown is 2 and 6, which is 2 shillings and 6 pence. And 6 pence is not 6p, it's 6d, meaning denarius. So after 2,000 years, we were still using d up until 1971.
And I think we figured out that that was 12 and a half pence.
Correct. That's 8 of them to the pound. And don't forget, in 1971, a pound was still a decent amount of money. I mean, if you walked into a shop with a pound note and you bought a bottle of milk and a newspaper, you'd apologise for having nothing smaller.
Oh, my goodness.
And if you earned £20 a week, you were doing very well. If you managed £25 a week, you could afford to buy a house on just one income. And that's in Dublin 50 years ago.
Yeah.
How times have changed.
You were saying in 1971, obviously the new currency was easier. Everything was divided by 10 or divided by 100, decimalization. The communications were quite good around it. So it was quite a seamless transition, was it?
It was very well flagged. The population were well educated by the government. They had lots of promotions going out on television, radio, posters in shops. They had tables showing the old values against the new values. And many of the shops and the new supermarkets that had just sort of arrived, they were dual priced. So they're showing you the price in the old money, like 2 and 6, half crown for an item, and 12.5p underneath. So there was no reason that anybody would get confused. But whenever a new currency is introduced, there are always complaints. I mean, some things never change. But it was quite seamless, and many people blame the new coins on inflation. And inflation was rampant in the 1970s. But I don't think it was caused by the new money. It was caused because the exchange rates, which had been fixed against the US dollar since 1934, Anthony Barber and a few other ministers around Europe decided to float the currencies, not have fixed exchange rates anymore. Because in 1967, Harold Wilson had to devalue the pound because he couldn't support it against the dollar or the German mark. The German mark was flying away ahead of everything. The story at the time was they lost the war, but they won the peace. And the German mark was supreme. So they floated all the currencies. The mark rose into the stratosphere and the pound dropped like a stone. So that's what caused the inflation.
And a big currency change like that in 1971 for your organization, that must be a seismic event, is it? That's big excitement.
It was. It was very interesting at the time. And we have a coin fair every year at the RDS in February and in October, which is in suspense at the moment. But we have about 30 dealers there from the UK, all over Ireland, and some from America and further. Even an Australian turned up the last time. And they buy and sell obsolete coins, and they like to educate the public about them. And they were in the vanguard, really, of explaining the new currency and the old currency and how they relate to each other. Yes, so we would have been very much involved in that, and still are.
What's the most valuable coin now? What's the prize asset, Michael, the one everyone is chasing?
A few years ago, a coin appeared at auction in Sotheby's in America. And it was estimated at $2 to $3 million. But when the hammer fell, it was over $7 million. It was a 1933 American double eagle with a face value of $20, because that's all it was worth in 1933. Why was it worth so much? Because Franklin D. Roosevelt, at the start of the Great Depression, he decided that America would have to go off the gold standard. Before that, the coins were made of gold and silver, and it had to be supported by the amount of gold in the vaults. They could no longer do it. There were soup queues, there were dust bowls. It was disastrous. So he decided to take America off the gold standard. Everybody had to return in their gold for paper money, which was a big ask, but they all did it in a patriotic frenzy. And they were all melted down. All the 1933 gold coins were melted down, but one escaped. How did it escape? In the diplomatic bag, by an international collector, King Farouk of Egypt. He was a megalomaniac who collected everything, jade, ivory, the whole lot. And he had agents going around for him. And one agent had diplomatic connections. And he was able to get hold of a 1933 double eagle just 2 days before this enactment came in. It went in the diplomatic pouch, and it finished up in Cairo, and it was there until just a few years ago when it surfaced. The FBI tried to seize it, but they wouldn't give it up. And in the end, they did a deal with the dealer who found it, and they said, look, why don't we auction it and we'll go 50-50? And that's what happened. So the dealer got $3.5 million, and the American Treasury got the other $3.5 million. So that was the dearest coin up until a few years ago, but there are other coins that have sold for more since. Most collectors are quite happy to have coins between, at our annual auction, the average price is 30 to 50 euros. You can still buy collectible coins for that kind of money. You don't have to be a millionaire.
I won't ask you about your collection, Michael. You might have people knocking on the door.
I might have, yes.
To do that.
Even not knocking on the door.
Exactly. And of course, the big change we can all relate to, well, a lot of people in Ireland can relate to, were the changes in 2002 when the euro came in. And I think I was saying to you that I had music stores at the time. And it was definitely a case of people getting rid of money that was under the mattress. There was a bonanza. And for some reason, people felt they couldn't bring the money to the bank. I'm not sure what was going on. Was that significant to your team?
No, again, it was well flagged. And that was even more seamless than the 1971. And I remember it well because I was up in Donegal at the time. And I took myself to a town called Pettigo, which straddles the border between the north and the south, to such an extent that on one side of the road, they had British sterling, and on the other side of the road, they had this new euro currency. And in between, they had the old decimal coinage as well. So I arrived there to find in this town, BBC cameras, Sky News reporters, all waiting to see what a bags the Irish would make of this changeover. And I remember seeing the little girl on the till at the end, and she had three tills in front of her. One till was for the new euros, one till was for the old Irish currency, and one till was for the British currency. So she was running three currencies, and it didn't matter what people put down on the counter, she just tottered it up on the till, gave them the change. Everything went, so there was no story here, boys. You can pack up and go home. It just worked. I was going to say like clockwork, but we don't have clockwork anymore.
And now, of course, in this near cashless society, when you have the Chinese takeaway arriving and you're desperately looking for €2 to tip the delivery man, it's got to the point where we nearly don't have coins. That must be a sad day for a currency, is it? Is that how you'd view it?
Not really for collectors, because the cashless society is coming all right. There was even a report on our own local radio of a beggar man on Grafton Street who had a machine that if you couldn't give him money, you could tap this thing and leave him a tip that way. So it is coming, but that won't mean an end to our hobby, because once a thing becomes obsolete, people begin to ask or question what went before. And obsolete currencies all around the world, of whatever country you're in, there's a huge interest in, especially if they're made of gold and silver and you have the means to be able to buy them and have a look at them. And they're very attractive in their own right as well, especially the Victorian coinages are beautiful. They're made of silver and gold. They're very large, most attractive. So I don't think they will ever really go out of fashion. In fact, there's a bit of a boom on at the moment. It's a paradox, really, that as the cash is going out, collecting the obsolete money is coming very much back in.
So this is good news for collectors, you're telling
me? I think so, yes. And
before I let you go, Michael, I have one last question for you. The death penny, was that actual currency?
No, that would have been a medal given to servicemen in the First World War, who either died in service or on active duty, whatever the case may be. It would have been sent to their relatives. And there were lots of them. There were so many fatalities in World War One that they're still quite common today. But they were never used as currency. That would just be a local colloquial name for it, a death penny. It was a large bronze medal that would virtually fit into the palm of your hand.
Okay, so it looked like a big penny, effectively, and that's where it would have got its name, I presume, was it?
Well, it's nothing like a penny, but
yeah, exactly.
It's much larger.
Yeah, so maybe people were being a little bit sarcastic.
Poetic license, we can put it down to.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for sharing the wonderful stories about Patrick Pearse, Henry VIII, and our Brian Boru harp, and of course, the double eagle. If I spot that somewhere, how would I recognize it?
You won't spot it. You'll never see it. If you see one, it'll be a fake. And there are plenty of fakes around, but we won't go down that road.
Michael, thank you so much. Good man yourself. Thank you for joining the Heritage Council podcast.
Thank you very much, Greg. Enjoyed that. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the next segment of this podcast, I chat with Michael Kenny, retired curator of the National Museum, about 1,000 years of coinage in Ireland that started with the Vikings. Thanks for listening. Michael Kenny, how are you doing?
Good evening. How are we?
We're very good. And you're the former curator for Art and Industrial Division of the National Museum.
Yes, that is something of a mouthful. But the National Museum has a couple of divisions. One is a folklife division, which is not based in Dublin. The second one is the archaeological material, the antiquities, which is based in the National Museum in Kildare Street. And the third one is the National Museum, the Art and Industrial Division, now based in Collins Barracks. So the Art and Industrial Division takes over where the archaeological material or where the antiquities division stopped. So we take over from maybe the 15th, 16th century. There's a grey area where one division sort of edges out and the other division edges in. But we deal with both the fine arts, which will be silver, coinage, costume, jewellery, all that world, and also the historical world of wars, risings, rebellions, guns, flags, uniforms, and so on. And of course, coins, which is our subject this evening.
Like the other Michael Kenny that I spoke to earlier, and this must be the biggest coincidence ever, that the two of you, we have the two Michael Kennys who are experts in coins and money.
The only difference between us is the other Michael got a second initial and I didn't. So that's the only, well, it's maybe one of a number of distinguishing features between us.
Yeah, and I think for him, it was a hobby and the coin collectors. And for you, it became your job and your role. I guess in a way, both of you kind of come at the same subject matter from a different point of view. And in the conversation I had with him, what we were basically doing was charting the big moments of time, the big moments in our history when currency changed. And of course, we're having this conversation, seeing as it's 50 years since the decimalization of our currency. And the big time periods we spoke about were 1823 and the Act of the Union and the change of our currency at that time, 1928. Which obviously was the free state and the need for our currency to change at that time. 1971, the decimalization, 50 years on. And of course, 2002, when we all joined the euro. And what I'd like to do with you, Michael, is maybe talk about the history of money and the history of coins and how we started to exchange things and how that would have changed on through the years. And I know from our conversation as well, there were a few very unusual moments in time where we weren't even using coins because of wars and battles and all that kind of thing. So I guess in a way, maybe I'm going to throw the ball to you or flip the coin to you and you start wherever you'd like to start.
Yeah, well, I suppose where I would like to start would where we start in terms of coins in Ireland and coins being used in Ireland is with the Vikings, because Celtic Ireland, Ireland pre-Vikings did not have or use coins. Roman coins have been found, so they weren't totally ignorant of coins and their usage. Roman coins, particularly Roman coins from Roman Britain, which was a coin-using world, Roman coins have been found here and there, but there's no evidence of them ever being used in the way in which we use coins in terms for straightforward transactional purposes. So the Vikings arrived to us just before the year 800.
Okay.
And then for the first 100 years or so, they didn't use coins. And as they developed, and they were a very adaptable people, they developed contacts with the Anglo-Saxon world, particularly, and with Northwestern Europe. And from about 900 or so, I'm roughing it now, from around 900 or so, they were became gradually a coin-using people. And they introduced coins into Ireland. So we are increasingly beginning to get coin hoards from in or around 900 onwards. And for that first maybe 100 years, the coins that were used were the coins that the Vikings brought in. That would be Anglo-Saxon coins mostly. And then the other Michael Kenny mentioned big moments. The big moment for us, a big moment for me as a museum person, was in or around the year 995. When the Dublin Vikings first issued their own coins. But those are, as far as we're aware, the first coins minted in Ireland by an Irish king, even if the Dublin Viking king. That general date for that is given as about 995, 96, or just before the turn of that century.
And Michael, can I ask you, while you're talking about 995 and the Dublin Vikings, would that have been
a currency just for Dublin, or would it have quickly been adopted throughout the whole island?
Vikings were a raiding and a trading people, so those coins found their way into Europe, they found their way to Scandinavia, they found their way into the interior of the country as well, because while the Vikings were raiding and trading, so were the Irish kingdoms were raiding and trading with the Vikings. And it's very interesting to note that the power at that point, the major power, this is before the arrival of Brian Boru on the scene, the major power was the King of Meath. So the ancient kingdom of Meath was cheek by jowl with the Dublin Vikings at wherever their borders were. And a lot of those coins of the Dublin Vikings have been found well into Middle Ireland and into my own world. I am Westmeath, actually. And one of the interesting points in the 80s and 90s in terms of coin hoards being found was that they were being found on crannogs and sites of one kind or another well into Middle Ireland in areas which weren't particularly associated with the Vikings. So it would suggest that the native Irish, at least in some parts of the country, in those areas which were closer to the Viking world, had at least some idea of the uses of coins and had obviously putting coins away, I presume, for trade purposes. But there's no evidence of coins having been issued by any of the Irish kingdoms, only by the Vikings.
And the coins that the Vikings were using at that time, were they all have a standard? Did they have a mark on them? Or how did they derive their value, you know?
The Vikings based their coin on the Anglo-Saxon penny. Now, the Anglo-Saxon penny in the 9th, 10th century, more or less the same position maybe as the American dollar in the 20th century. It was the currency against which other currencies were, in a sense, measured. And the Vikings, simply in the early stages anyway, they simply copied what they found. So they, when they arrived in England and they started to use coinage, they copied the coinage of the Anglo-Saxon kings. And that, at that point, that was the silver penny. The silver penny was the universal coin of that period. Now, when King Sitric of Dublin started to issue his coinage in the 990s, again, he copied what he saw, and he copied what his people were using. So they copied the Anglo-Saxon penny of the contemporary English Anglo-Saxon king, a king called Ethelred. Now, the copying was rather rough and ready in a sense that, not sure how you would use the word. They weren't necessarily cheating as such. They just saw a coin and they copied it. So you have this strange mixture in around the year 1000 where you can pick up a silver coin and it says London on the back of it. And when you look at the front of it, it says King Sitric, which means the King Sitric name on the front of it, and put London or York or whatever came to hand on the back of it. There wasn't the same demarcation. And they copied what they saw. And it can be something of a headache for coin people figuring out, is this a Dublin coin? Is this an English coin? Is this an English coin pretending to be a Dublin coin, or a Dublin coin pretending to be an English coin? And sometimes not easy because of the rather casual approach they use towards the minting of their coin.
And the standardization or the recognition of the value, did that come from the metal that they were using and the size of them?
The metal was silver. And was supposed to be of a certain standard of silver. And the Anglo-Saxons, the coinage of England at this time is quite regular, quite regularized, well administered. You have mints and moneyers, and the coins are supposed to be of a certain weight. And given that they were struck by hand, they are, the vast majority of them, very, very close to what they should be. It's amazing that people at this point, working with the tools that they had, could produce a coinage that was amazingly consistent. Now, the Vikings in the early days did produce coins that were very much, should we say, up to scratch, to use that term. But later on, there's a decrease in the silver content. The amount of silver in the silver coin didn't remain consistent. And when you get into the 12th century, there's a big question mark over who actually was issuing the coins, because they become very poor quality. They become rather, instead of getting legends and king's titles, you're getting strokes and squiggles. In other words, they're becoming essentially illiterate. and it's not quite clear who or what the issuing authority was at all. One suggestion is that those later Dublin Viking coins, the ones that are poor quality, lightweight, and we'll use the word illiterate, that they were possibly issued just as trading tokens rather than by a king as such. It's unclear, and there's been different theories over the years.
So the trading token, in a way, was just a way of acknowledging the trade, and it was just a way to acknowledge a bit of value, whereas the others had intrinsic value themselves because they were silver.
The trading element was of course of huge importance, but it also had the political importance, the political significance of, say, a legend and a coin, and whether King Sidric called himself King of Ireland or King of Dublin or wherever, that's important. So you had the political message, and the political message was always fairly strong on coins which were issued by kings. And the reason why the thinking is that those later Viking coins might not have been issued by a royal authority is that there is no apparent issuing authority figured on them. So possibly they just might have been issued by merchants and traders for their own purposes rather than be the political messages that the earlier ones were. The Vikings in Dublin struck their first coins from around 990s and then right through the 11th century. But the Scandinavian kingdoms of Denmark and Norway and Sweden, Viking kingdoms also issued coins around the same time and went through, as I think, somewhat the same procedure. The earlier ones are very strong, very clear and very political, and the later ones not so much so. And thinking is that, again, that they might have been issued for different reasons.
And something that you said to me when we were chatting earlier, Michael, was that coins really tell a story, don't they? Like, they're pieces of history. They tell a story of the time. What you were chatting to me there about was very quickly the kings and the leaders, the currency went with whoever was the ruler.
Yes, there were political statements in their own way. It was important for King Sidric to state that he was King of Dublin. He was copying what he saw the Anglo-Saxon king doing on the other side of the water. And that's going right through history. We have examples of similar royal pretensions figuring on the coins. King Henry is probably Henry VIII, the infamous Henry VIII, him of the many wives. He was a very good example. The earlier coins he struck for Ireland has him listed as Henricus Dominus Hiberniae. He was Lord of Ireland. Then around 1540 or thereabouts, he decided to promote himself and titled himself Henricus Rex, King of Ireland. So that's a step up from Lord of Ireland to King of Ireland. And the earlier coins are called Dominics for that reason, Dominus coins. And the later ones are called Rex coins. That's among collectors because he, at this point, decided to upgrade his Irish title. So he wasn't just Lord of Ireland, he was King of Ireland. You have a similar one with coinage of the early Stuarts. I think King James the First of England, who was King James the Sixth of Scotland. He was originally King of England and Scotland and then upgraded himself, as it were, to King of Great Britain. Those titles and those little movements are interesting. And it's the same with continental coins. If the King of France was also the Count of Flanders or somewhere else, he made sure that his title got on the coin. Or if the King of Spain was also Emperor of the whatever in South America, he made sure that title or elements of it got onto his coins. But the coins, they were propaganda in their own way, propaganda and political messages, as well as having the regular practical function of trade, being trading units and facilitating trade and commerce.
And how did they evolve from one regime to the other? Were they smelting them, or what were they doing to get rid of one batch and bring in the new batch?
Coins could be brought in and restruck and reissued. There were big reworkings of coins at different times, particularly in the medieval period. And you had a movement from, say, the silver penny was the great coin of, say, the 12th, 13th, 14th century. And then there was as people became more urbanized, as trade became more globalized, as trading functions required, and coins changed. So the silver, as well as the silver penny, we got the fourpence or groat a bigger coin. And at a later stage, then you had the sixpence and the shilling and the 2 shilling. All of this, or most of it, was dictated by trade and the needs of trade and the increasing movement of people. And then, of course, particularly then the discovery of the New World. You had a lot of silver swishing around, particularly after the Spanish discovered their South American silver mines. So coins began to move and coins began to change, and you get different denominations. That runs all across the European empires that developed. The penny, which had been originally of great importance, became sort of, you know, a rather more humble coin.
And Michael, I know there were periods of time when, for whatever reason, coins weren't available and you needed an alternative. You had a particular phrase to describe that, didn't you?
We had coins that were pressed into service in the Cromwellian period. You had siege money, for example. And the siege money, as the title suggests, the siege money was issued to towns which were under siege. Cork is a prime example. It's the great example where towns like Bandon and Yall and Kinsale and Cork City itself all had issued coins for emergency issues, either to pay troops or to pay for provisions or to commandeer guns. They issued coins with whatever metal was available and in whatever manner they could. If they lacked my minting machinery, it just put them out. So you have oval coins and rectangular coins, and they're nominally coins. They were pressed into service and made use of. And the greatest example in Irish history probably is the reign of the wars of King James and King William, because King James, who was perpetually short of money, in 1689, I think it was, issued proclamations pulling in a lot of, base metal, or copper, bronze, lead, brass. And he issued what is essentially, I suppose, a token coinage of crowns, half crowns, shillings and sixpence, but minting them in a base metal. And they're most unusual in the sense that they carry not just the year, but also the month in terms of their date. And the reasoning for that, apparently, or so it is said, was that had he won the war, that those coins would have been pulled back in and taken out of circulation on a month-by-month basis. But of course he didn't. He lost the war, and vast numbers of those coins were initially, I think King William had them brought back down to their actual metal value, which was virtually nothing. And so that they say, well, somebody who had a half crown found that they had a penny, and they were then demonetized, and they're out there, and they're still out there in huge numbers. It's called gun money, and the title gun money comes from the fact that those coins were actually made in, not in all cases, but in lots of cases, from melted down gun barrels. So, in other words, they used whatever was at hand. They called it whatever they wanted to call it. And the unfortunates who were paid in that sort of money when they lost the war found themselves, their pockets full of useless metal. It's what happened. It's a collector's dream, of course, because you have coins are issued not just by the denomination, shilling, sixpence, eightpence, crown, half crown, whatever, but also issued by the month for the entire period of the Williamite War.
And forgery must have been a big deal at that time, was it?
Forgery was always a big deal, and the penalties for forgery were pretty horrific in the early medieval period. There are, in the English context, the official penalties for forgery, I think you could have your hands chopped off, various horrible things could happen to you. I think there was one period under Henry I or Henry II when other more intimate parts of your body could be chopped off as well. But it didn't stop forgers from doing their thing. And I have seen one or two little, certainly for the later period, 18th century, little what you might call forging kits, where coins were cast rather than struck. And I suppose on a wet Saturday night in Athlone or somewhere, you could get away with it for small scale transactions. I don't know how closely those things were monitored or checked, but for the serious, at the more serious level, I'm sure they were very, very well scrutinized. Also, in terms of 17th and 18th century, there were instructions, proclamations, rules for the circulation of foreign coins. And those rules and regulations came with weights and values. So in other words, your Spanish silver coin should weigh X. And if it did weigh X, you got Y for it. So it's more or less like rates of foreign exchange nowadays. The Spanish coin should be of a certain weight, and if it did, it was worth 5 shillings, and the other French coin would be worth something else, and worth, say, 3 shillings or whatever. There are rules and regulations, and for that reason, there are sets of coin weights issued specifically for the purpose of weighing, checking and measuring the foreign coins, because there were a lot of foreign coins in circulation. So it must have been from a trader's point of view, or a merchant's point of view, something of a nightmare in a sense, to have foreign coins switching around the place, and number one, not being too sure whether they were real or not real, but then having to weigh them and check them and check whatever the latest ordinance from Dublin Castle or from Dublin was regarding their value.
You needed to get something of value and know what that value was.
And know what that value was in a changing world where you wouldn't have possibly handled an awful lot of them. The coin that you used every day of the week was fine, but a strange, Portuguese gold coin coming into your possession, you were wondering, oh, what's this good for? But there was an official, guy put in charge of making money weights every so often, and a royal ordinance would be issued, and a list of values would come out in the late 17th century and early 18th century. But it still must have been something of a nightmare for traders and merchants.
But they still managed, Michael, however they did it.
People almost managed and have to manage where money is concerned. And there's a shortage as well. If there was, certainly during much of the medieval period, a shortage of coins in Ireland, a shortage of coins full stop. So when the Spanish in particular discovered the New World, Europe became awash with silver coins, and Spanish silver was very acceptable. And it might have been rough and ready, but in terms of its silver content, of the goodness of their silver, they were fine. And the big problem was, again, laying down ordinances and rules relating to the value and the valuation of this stuff. They've been found in quite a few Irish hoards. You often find Spanish coins popping up, particularly in the 17th century.
And you mentioned coins as propaganda, and obviously changing a currency at a time in Ireland when it's very politically sensitive, you're going to have particular trouble. And I know in 1928, you were giving me a lot of the background as to why certain things ended up on coins. Could you talk me through some of the politics of that time?
Our story there starts in, I think it's 1926, a committee set up under the chairmanship of the famous W.B. Yeats to look at setting out or organising designs for a new Irish currency, because the new Irish Free State was beginning to, throw political shapes in the world, and embassies were being opened. And it was thought that we should have our own coinage. But of course, it was another question to decide how we should go about it. Yeats chaired a committee that was set up, I think it was in 1926, and they were given a brief to find designers and to find designs. And they, very revolutionary for the time, they set up a committee, which brought in several foreign designers, one of them American, there was a Swede, a couple of Irish, and a British one, and an Italian one, and a Croat. So several famous designers were asked to submit their designs for this new Irish coinage. But the biggest issue, and the winner was a British designer called Percy Metcalfe. The big problem was what would be put on them. Now, we had just gone through a civil war, so putting political figures or personages would be very, very difficult and sensitive.
The fact that they chose a British designer must have been a bit controversial in its own right, was it?
It most certainly was, because a lot of people were complaining that if we had a coinage, if we were to set up a coinage, could we at least get one of our own people to design it? But it was set out internationally, and one of the finest designers was an Italian called Morbiducci, who beautiful designs he had. But it was, I think the thinking was, one of the reasons why Percy Metcalfe, the British designer, made it, he himself, I think, my recollection is he worked in the British Mint. So he was very on the ball in terms of the practicalities, and that was what helped him. And one of the finest ones, just visually, was Morbiducci, the Italian one, where his coins were somewhat maybe too heavy, for want of a better word. The whole story of that coinage, there's some of it is quite comical. Some people wanted saints, some people wanted kings and queens, some people wanted people from Irish mythology. Then when it was decided to go for the flora and fauna of Ireland, you know, the horse and the salmon, the bull and the pig, and the non-political features, which it did appear on that coinage, there was an outcry in certain quarters that this was a heathen coinage, and that we should make more effort to show religious symbols and symbolism. But of course, we didn't want to get into religious symbols and symbolism either. And there were some comical stories of people being worried that if you had a coinage with, say, St. Patrick and St. Bridget, and with people playing pitch and toss, that it would all be a bit undignified.
Or you can't have them landing on top of each other.
You can't have them landing on top of each other, or people turning up their coins in the bar at night to see whether they had got St. Colin Killer, St. Brendan, or whatever. There are a number of funny stories, and there are a number of angry letters in the newspapers. And I think, by and large, when it did get underway, the Irish coinage was much lauded and applauded. And it, like, it set an example for other countries like Canada and Australia, then in the Commonwealth, to look not at personages and not at emperors and heroes and kings, but at the flora and fauna of their own countries. So the Irish coinage, whatever about the jokes and the rows at its inception, was very well received internationally.
Do you think Yeats regretted taking on that job?
He stuck to his guns. He wasn't an easy person to deal with, I think. Some of the correspondence and the archival material relating to that period shows a lot of, angst and squabbles. But when it did hit the road, it was a very successful and very highly thought of internationally. This was a new road for coinage and coin design.
And between then, Michael, and decimalization in 71, did those designs stick, or do they continue to evolve?
They largely stuck. There was a switch, of course, in 1937 with the new constitution. The early ones up to 1937 had Saoirse Éireann, the Irish Free State. And then, of course, the 1937 constitution came in, and we went through that limbo period from 37 to 49. We weren't a free state and we weren't a republic. And whoever was the political leadership at that time would have been Eamon de Valera. So either Eamon de Valera or one of his ministers or some of his civil servants, someone came up with a bright idea, good civil service one indeed, when in doubt, leave it out. So they didn't call it Public na Héireann because we weren't Public na Héireann. They didn't call it Saoirse Éireann because we were no longer a Saoirse. They just put era, those kinds. And that term era has stayed with us since on our coinage, and I think also in our stamps, actually. I know a little about stamps, but certainly on our coinage. Amusing me a little bit, sometimes you find people complaining bitterly about people on the other side of the water, British people referring to Ireland as era, but that's what we call it ourselves. If you take an Irish coinage and a coin and look at it, it doesn't say Ireland or Public na Héireann or anything else, it says era.
We think that that's someone who doesn't understand Ireland using that term. And as you say, it's quite an obvious one, isn't it, when we put it on our currency?
If it's on your currency and on your stamps, you can hardly complain about other people using the term. And it certainly was less of a mouthful than Saoirse Éireann, you know, for English speakers anyway.
And the process then around 1971?
More modern world and a different sets of ideas. The new editions were designed by a designer called Gabriel Hayes, who actually was from Leixlip, where I live, as it turns out. And there is a letter extant somewhere in the National Museum from the designer of the 1928 coinage, Percy Metcalfe, still alive as a very old man, and congratulating Gabriel Hayes on her achievement. The denominations themselves, the New Decimal World, I suppose, didn't initially bring in a huge change in the sense that we continue to use the designs that we had. Okay, they're appearing in different denominations and, you know, odd and strange things happened. And the woodcock who had been on the lowly farthing, I think, ended up on a 50 pence piece and at a later stage. But oddly enough, the various movements through decimalisation, the initial move in 71 and then the new denominations and new designs coming on later on, I wouldn't claim to know as much about the earlier material because I thought it's closer to me. But my big work that I got involved in came not for in 71 when I was still a student indeed, but in 2001 when the next great move came, which was towards to the euro. And at that point, the euro kicked in, as far as I remember, in January, February of 2002. I can't remember the date. But in the National Museum, we were in a position to put up a nice coin exhibition in 2001, which would take account of decimalisation and all the new changes that had come upon it, and also exhibit and show the new euro coins and notes. And for that, I must say, we're very grateful to the Central Bank, because the Central Bank at that point helped us and assisted us in all sorts of ways and gave us examples of the new notes and the new coins so that we were able to get them up and get them on exhibition and have them in a place for people to come and see them actually before they were in a position to handle them. So that exhibition, 2001, was of major importance for us. And in its own way, just even as a date, it signalled just about 1,000 years of Irish coinage. Because, as I said, our friend Sidwick, way back in the 990, at the end of the 10th century, in 995. So that exhibition in 2001 more or less covered, or tried to cover it as best we could, to the best of our abilities at the time, 1,000 years of Irish coinage.
1,000 years, good, my goodness. So, Michael, if I find my way to the National Museum and I'm looking at the coin collection, are there a few very specific pieces I should be looking out for, your favourites?
The Viking coins are of huge importance. They're also very interesting silver pennies of, say, the 13th century, when Irish coins were quite distinct to this extent that the vast majority of European coins at this point profile the king or leader or emperor or whatever in a circle. And the vast majority of coins have, in fact, used the circular design, as the present ones do indeed. But on the Irish pennies and halfpennies of the 13th and 14th century, the king's head wasn't in a circle, it was in a triangle. So if you saw a coin with the king's head in a triangle, you knew immediately it wasn't, even if it was worn, and even if you were having difficulty deciphering it, if it was in a triangle, you knew that it was an Irish coin. And the owl triangle, should we call it, a very distinctive feature on Irish coins for maybe 200 years or thereabouts. The other one thing that are of interest, of course, is the siege money, because it's different.
Yeah.
And the gun money of the 1690s, because it's different. And the trading tokens in the 1650s, a lot of traders' tokens as well. And they're historical documents in their own right, because they will tell you normally, or in other cases, the trade of that particular person. So yes, if the butcher, a baker, or a candlestick maker, or a goldsmith in Kenny, or whatever, they normally give you the name of the person and that trade or craft. So you get some idea of what was happening in small town Ireland and what the trades were, what the crafts were. And that in itself is another little nugget. And what I've found is that the byroads of history are always more interesting than the high roads. And it's those little small twists and turns, or why somebody was doing something and then stopped doing it. Why somebody was the king of somewhere and then suddenly wasn't, and you wonder what happened to him. The little sort of sidelines where you have information that it's small and it's obscure, but you can dig things out. That's what I found most interesting in any coinage.
They're part of our history. They tell us who we were. They carry all of those stories. Yeah, they're part of our heritage.
They're one of the few forms of history that all of us, at one time or another, will have handled.
Michael, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Heritage Council podcast. For more information about our projects and programs, our work with others and our publications, please check our website, heritagecouncil.ie. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. See you again soon.